When I was young, my parents tried to convince me that algebra came from an Arabic word. I think they thought that I would see it as part of my heritage and I would be more likely to do it. It half worked. I really enjoyed math until right around high school. But it was only years later that I could appreciate the history of math in the Muslim world when I encountered it in an academic setting in histories of math. So if I were trying to do the same thing today with astronomy, with the next generation, I think I would have a bit of help. I would turn to the work of today's guest, who works on 19th century astronomy in Egypt. My name is Ena Mansour, or Nadira, and welcome to New Books in Middle East Studies, part of the New Books Network. Today, my guest is Dan Stoltz, who is currently a visiting assistant professor of history at Northwestern University, where he is also affiliated with the Science and Human Culture program. And in September, he will be an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He received his PhD from Princeton University in Near Eastern Studies. He is a historian of the modern Middle East, specializing in Egypt and the late Ottoman Empire, and is the author of many articles on science and religion in Egypt, and a monograph, the subject of today's podcast interview, The Lighthouse and the Observatory, Islam, Science, and Empire in Late Ottoman Egypt, out 2018 from Cambridge University Press. Welcome to the podcast, Dan. So this book is striking to me as a history of science in the Middle Eastern context, because it is both a history of science in the Middle Eastern context, but is also a study of Islam. And I wonder at times whether or not, until very recently, maybe the last two decades, we've neglected the history of science in Middle Eastern studies. Sort of, what's your assessment of the field of the history of science today in Middle East studies?
Right. I'm really encouraged by the state of history of science in Middle East studies today. And I would say more broadly, science and technology studies, just because I think, we definitely want to include really interesting work in anthropology right now as well. And, you know, you're absolutely right that, you know, the way things developed historically, there was a very specialized field that focused on the history of science in pre-modern Islamic contexts, right? The translation movement, right? The development of astronomy, as well as medicine, mathematics, right? In that kind of classical context, in a way that, you know, wasn't really connected with certainly modern Middle East history, or even always with other areas in the history of science. And there wasn't a lot of attention to the history of science in the modern Middle East, except maybe as a kind of, you know, history of diffusion from the West. And I think, you know, in the last couple of decades, as you say, that's really changed. And one of the things that's really encouraging to me is that there it's not just a matter of kind of the quantity of work in science and technology studies, you know, in the Middle East today, but also the extent to which that work is really part of the conversation more broadly. So that if, you know, you're writing on, you know, whatever it is, whether it's Arab nationalism or the Islamic revival, or whether you're doing social history or cultural history, I think people are increasingly aware that science, technology, medicine are part of that picture, and you know, in ways that are informed methodologically as well, right, by the way that people in science studies approach science, right, as something which is, you know, socially situated and produced, and not just kind of present and taken for granted the way that it is. So I'm thrilled to, you know, to be kind of writing in that field today with not just, you know, an increasing number of colleagues, but to be, you know, part of broader conversations.
I think one of the accomplishments of the book truly is that you really just elucidate why we should care about the history of science, and more specifically the history of astronomy, because this book is a study of astronomy. So what is your intellectual biography? How did you come to study astronomy specifically in the Islamic or the Muslim context?
Well, I chose astronomy as the subject of the book largely because I was interested in incorporating the ulama into our understanding of science in the modern Middle East, particularly in the late Ottoman period. I'd always been interested in science in that context, understanding the politics and the translation of science in the late Ottoman, especially late Ottoman Arab society, was really the interest that brought me into graduate school to begin with. And one of the things I noticed was that history was really centered on kind of new social classes, right? And even new media like print periodicals, right, in that period, and new institutions as well, schools, right? And it struck me, right, especially given the amount of attention in Islamic studies recently to the role of ulama in modernity, right, that this was a social group which was really missing from our understanding of what was happening with science in that period. And I chose astronomy, right, as a science which I thought, you know, had the potential to integrate ulama into that story because of the very rich history of science in Islamic context, right? Because of those intersections with Ramadan, with the timing of prayer, because of the history of astrology, right? All of these things, right? It just struck me as a having a very rich potential to tell a more socially complex story, maybe, about science in the late Ottoman period. What I discovered is that it also had these other intersections that I didn't anticipate, in particular with the history of the late Ottoman Egyptian state. Right, and the extent to which the Khedivial government in the 19th century, and then later the British administration in Egypt, were invested in building astronomical institutions as well. That was a surprise to me. That was not something that I had anticipated. It's not surprising in the bigger scheme of things, right? That's something that. All kinds of states in the 19th century are doing, using astronomy to draw maps, to survey, to draw borders. But it was surprising to me at the time. So it wound up being a subject through which I could kind of connect the ulama and forms of Islamic authority with new forms of political power as well.
So is that why you specifically chose Ottoman Egypt as a setting? Because it sort of had all these different elements that could tie into astronomy? Or was there a specific reason why you focused on Egypt and Cairo in particular and its suburbs and not, for example, Aleppo or Istanbul?
Sure. I think one could have done the project in any number of ways. And even within the framework of late Ottoman Egypt, there are different geographies that are relevant in the book. So when it comes to this kind of state building astronomy, let's call it, you know, the building of a state observatory, the production of maps, navigational technology, time distribution, that's a part of the book which is fairly centered on Egypt, because the Khedivial government and later the British were really using astronomy to define Egypt, right, as such in that period, in ways that kind of were very deliberately kind of separating it to some extent from, you know, from Arab or Ottoman or Islamic communities. At the same time, when it comes to the production of ulama, let's say, right, those are people who are very engaged in a more Islamic geography, right? I mean, they're coming to Cairo very often from other Ottoman lands or even from further afield. And the kind of circulation of texts and even timekeeping practices, right, kind of connects Egypt with other parts of the Ottoman and Islamic geography. So there are different, you know, even just to say kind of late Ottoman Egypt, right, is to kind of reduce some of the geographical complexity, right, that shows up in the book, I think. In terms of choosing Egypt, I mean, one thing that was really interesting to me was the complexity of imperialism in that moment, right? So, right, you have this household, right, of Mehmed Ali Pasha, right, and his descendants, the Khedives, who are, you know, essentially building, you know, an empire within the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century. So you have both kind of Ottoman and Ottoman Egyptian political frameworks that are relevant. Then you have the British, right, later in the 19th century, right? So you have this kind of nested or multiple imperialisms, right, on the ground, all of which are using science to advance their aims. So that struck me as a story within the history of science and empire that was a bit different from the view one typically gets, say, where empire is really centered on Europe, right, and kind of colonizing, right, other parts of the world in the 19th century, right? This is a story in which there is that kind of Eurocentric empire, but there's also a Cairo-centered empire, right, and an Istanbul-centered empire, right? So that, to me, was one of the appeals of writing this as an Ottoman Egyptian history, was to highlight something a bit unusual, a bit different in terms of science and empire, in kind of where it's centered and being centered in multiple places in the 19th century.
I really admire that about the book, is that you sort of, there are many different categories that we have to contend with as people who work on the 19th century. And you very elegantly allied many of them by picking your own sort of categories and setting them, such as you mentioned, picking the idea, like using Ottoman Egypt to describe your world, because, or the setting, because Ottoman can communicate so many different things about where Egypt is at that point of time. It's just such an elegant solution. You mentioned earlier, you alluded to some of the principal characters in your book, which are the ulama, Islamic scholars, so to speak. And religious authority sort of just charges through the book. What a religious authority means, how it's enacted, what these institutions connote and how they change, like Al-Azhar, the famed I hesitate to say Islamic institution, because in our current day and age, it's so many different things. But it's the famed sort of universe, like it's the center of Islamic learning that has sort of become very iconic. But today, for example, includes a dentistry school, a very good dentistry school, and a very good faculty of languages, right. And so many different things.
Engineering.
So, yep. And I mean, yeah. But at the same time, to be an Azharite has this connotation of Islamic learning, and they actually, all students do have to take a year of Islamic sciences. So you have all these institutions, all these characters, and how is religious authority negotiated between them? Is religious authority simply a top-down phenomenon? How does it function in the case of astronomy in particular?
Well, one of the things that I tried to capture in the book is the way in which authority is negotiated, as you say, relationally, right? So that it's not top down, or let's say it's not only top down, because there absolutely are instances in which state actors will, you know, institute new practices, whether it's, you know, so an iconic example of this, right, is implementing a standard mean time system, right, at the very beginning of the 20th century, centered on Greenwich, right? And that, you know, has reverberations, some of them quite unintended, for how people are timing prayer and scheduling prayer in Cairo, especially. At the same time, though, one of the things I wanted to draw attention to in the book is the extent to which people outside the state and outside of you know, central institutions like the Azhar were also really interested in kind of mobilizing new sciences and taking advantage of, kind of enlisting some of these new institutions in their own projects to advance their own visions. In some cases, right, these are visions that have to do with Islamic unity, the unity of the Ummah in the early 20th century, right? So I write about people like Muhammad Rashid Rida and people in his circle writing in the journal Al-Manar, who were really interested in using astronomy and new sciences more generally to advance a view about what modern Islamic education should be, about kind of correct ways to read the Quran, about you know, kind of unity in terms of prayer practice. Right? So science becomes a way in which all kinds of actors, in a sense, a kind of resource, right, for all kinds of actors to deploy for their own purposes. And I think authority often was constituted in that sort of push and pull, right, between kind of central institutions and broader movements in the press, especially at that time.
So the book in particular is titled The Lighthouse and the Observatory, and it's a bit on the nose. And I was wondering about those institutions of astronomy and how they're expressed during the 19th century. Are they necessarily new institutions, observatories and the like?
Well, you know, just to be clear, right? So the observatory that that the title refers to is, you know, is definitely a new institution in late Ottoman Egypt. It's actually several institutions, right? There's this sort of iterative process where, you know, almost every kind of government kind of builds its own observatory. Mehmed Ali Pasha builds an observatory. Ismail Pasha, right, builds an observatory in the 1860s. The British build a new observatory in around 1903. The lighthouse refers to El Minar, right? Refers to that journal, which of course itself is a reference to a hadith, right, in which the Prophet Muhammad had said that, you know, Islam has or contains a beacon or a lighthouse, right, like a beacon on a path or along the road. And, you know, in a sense, what I was trying to do with that title was to pose the question, you know, what is the relationship between these two things, right? Between the establishment of these kinds of central scientific institutions in the late Ottoman period and a conception of Islam that is promulgated, right, in journals like El Minar, right, which cast themselves, right, which casts itself, right, the journal, right, is the beacon, right, and which sees itself as a kind of center around which a global ummah, right, can organize itself, right, around a kind of single correct standard, right? I mean, that is, you know, an increasingly prominent and active kind of project in the, especially in the early, by the time we get to the early 20th century, of kind of defining Islam, right, around as something which has this kind of single and not only correct standard, but a standard that is clear, right, for anyone who can kind of look at it. And so, you know, in that title, I was trying to, in a sense, ask the question, you know, what is the relationship between that conception of Islam, right, and the growth of these central scientific institutions? Because I think both are new, right, to an extent. I mean, both obviously also have histories. But the prominence that they attain, you know, by the early 20th century, I think is new and is connected, right? Right, that this project to remake, right, Islam as something which is kind of uniform across time and space, as I say in the book, I think is connected to the growth of these scientific institutions and more broadly this conception of knowledge, right, and practice, right, scientific practice as things that transcend time and space.
I think one of the conversations the field has been having, especially the field of 19th century Middle Eastern history has been having, is how to talk about rupture and change. And you illustrated it right there. There are some forms of thought or practice that are completely new. And then there are some forms that, and those forms can still be rooted in the past. So as you mentioned, Al-Manar is, I mean, Al-Manar and the magazines and journals that both preceded it and were contemporary to it were very, you know, they drew on older forms of writing in the Islamic tradition, other forms of writing in the Arabic tradition. But they definitely also, I mean, to have a journal that was distributed amongst an increasingly literate class was new.
Right.
And that's just one such example, I think. And you, again, deal with it very elegantly by sort of not discussing outright whether or not there's rupture or continuity at all. You just sort of take it as a fact that they're both. So one thing
I wonder whether I should have been more explicit about that as you say that. I mean, one of the things that was so astonishing to me or just so noteworthy was how old some of these practices are, which become normative, right, in the 20th century, right? So it's something like, you know, the use of mathematical astronomy to define the schedule of prayers, right? I mean, this is phenomenally old, right? Certainly in Cairo, right? I mean, it has 1,000 years, right? In that discipline of miqat, right? Of timekeeping. And even institutionally, right? You know, things like mosque timekeepers, right? I mean, there's a very thriving, it's a very thriving institution in the Mamluk period, right? In Cairo. But the way in which this is then used, especially when it's connected with a periodical press, when it's connected with technologies like telegraphy, when it's connected with you know, a modern state institution, right, in the 20th century, right, that practice takes on a whole new life that looks almost categorically different, right, even though it is tied to this very old form of knowledge, right? So it's in a sense, rupture and continuity, I would say, I mean, we tend to contrast them, right, or pose them as binaries, right? But in an interesting way, the rupture, right, is represents a continuity, right? I mean, it flows from, right, this not kind of knowledge which is 1,000 years old.
And then when you sort of think about how ideas are added together, how they're subtracted, not subtracted, but how, where ideas come from, to some extent, the justification for using new technologies to produce, for example, times for prayer is rooted in other religious rulings. I mean, it's a very sort of, there's just different Islamic sciences that plug in and out of this, but at the same time, I agree with you. I think everything is sort of a birth and a death, a rupture and a continuity at the same time. And it's just these different permutations and combinations that happen that make it so interesting to watch. And I think that nuance, I'm encouraged by the fact that I think increasingly a lot of the books I've been reading recently approach the history of ideas in particular this way. So I don't know, I'm excited about this wave of history writing, but to sort of get back at things that don't quite exactly change as quickly, or perhaps something that's rooted in an older form. You spend a lot of time with manuscripts for this book.
Yeah.
And in particular, one genre of writing, the Zij. So what does it consist of? If I was to pick up a manuscript, how would it feel like? How would it look like?
So the Zij is a handbook, right? I mean, we might think of it almost as a kind of manual. A set of instructions, right? So it's very different, say, from a treatise, right? Or, you know, any genre of writing which, you know, you might pick up and just kind of read, right? The Zij is, I like to say, the Zij is a text that was meant to be used as much as it was read, right? And a lot of the manuscripts that I looked at for this project were Zij commentaries. So that's a little bit different because there you do get more of the kind of typical structure of a sharh, right? And those are typically kind of pedagogical texts, right, which are meant to explain the use of these handbooks to you know, people who are becoming learned in the science. They tend to be fairly comprehensive as pedagogical texts in the sense that they assume relatively little. And so you would, you know, as I write in the book, you know, everything from, you know, how to add, you know, to how to predict the position of a planet, you know, would be, you know, could be included in that kind of commentary. They tend to follow a certain structure in terms of the kinds of questions that they deal with. So a lot of it has to do with the calendar or calendars, actually. So typically there will be discussions of the Hijri calendar and how to determine the first of the months of the Hijri calendar. Typically also the Coptic calendar especially for Zijas produced in the Middle East and certainly in Egypt. Persian calendar typically shows up as well, the Jewish or Hebrew calendar, often also the what's it called, the Rumi calendar, right? And there will also be a lot of discussion of how to kind of convert dates between those systems. So a lot of typically the first several sections would be kind of occupied with calendrical knowledge, including knowledge of the holidays. Right? And it's always interesting to see how much knowledge there was, you know, for, let's say, a Muslim scholar, right, in 19th century Egypt, you know, to be able to write about, you know, the different festivals on different church calendars, as well as the Jewish calendar. So you'd also find always sections on timekeeping, right, how to determine the hours of the day, the hours of prayer, and then also sections on determining the position of the planets. And it's pretty clear, often explicit, that that practice was connected with Ahkam al-Nujum, right? The astrology, the judgments of the stars, right? The actual interpretation, right? Astrological interpretation of planetary positions, right? It's typically not included or not necessarily included in these handbooks, right? That would be a separate genre of writing, right? But it's kind of expected, right, that this kind of astronomical practice of predicting the position of the planets or determining where they were in the past, right, is in a sense kind of linked with their astrological interpretation. It's a text that that was used, right? And certainly one shouldn't assume that all parts of it were used equally by all users, right? There were contexts in which the sections on timekeeping might have been really important, or the sections on the Coptic calendar might have been really important, or the sections on the Hijri calendar, right? So that's why I encourage you to think of it as a manual, right? Just like you wouldn't pick up a manual and read it, from cover to cover, right? You're going to pick it up to solve the problem that you're having, right, with whatever you're trying to use, right? And the Zij, similarly.
So another thing that I really admire about the book is your ability to connect texts together. And I think often those of us who come up in Islamic studies, and we were talking a little bit before the interview about how we'd taken a similar puzzle-y Islamic studies class when you were in grad school and I took it a couple of years ago in grad school. And you follow texts quite well, and you're able to put them in conversation with each other, which is sort of another layer on top of that ability to sort of fit all these different pieces of the puzzle together. And one thing you do in particular is you're able to trace different translations of texts from European languages into Arabic and the interaction with them. So sort of what is the role of translation? How do these texts move in this world? Sort of what's both the physical and the ideational movement of going on here?
And sometimes in surprising ways. And one of the things that was really interesting to me in following or tracing the movement of astronomical texts was the, all the different sorts of directions or in which texts move, right? I think, we were talking about the Nahda earlier, and I think, there's this conventional or just sort of assumed geography, right, in which things were translated, basically from French or English into Arabic or Turkish, right? The pathways, right, that come out in the book are obviously there was translation from French into Arabic and from English into Arabic, but there was also translation from, Russian into Turkish, and from Turkish into Arabic, right? Or from Russian into Persian, right? And from Persian, right, into Turkish and Arabic. Different kind of geographies of translation come into play, and different centers of translation as well, right? It was really interesting to me to see things being translated in Demyat, right? In Demyata, in the early 19th century. And it turns out that this is actually not totally surprising, right? There is this kind of circle of translators there, which other people have worked on as well in terms of translation of literature into Arabic in that period. The same, they're also doing astronomy. People who had connections across the Mediterranean or were in a position either because of their religious communities or their merchant communities to have some capacity in different languages, right? These are people who are moving texts, acquiring texts, still from Italy as well, by the way, right? Not just France or England, and translating them. And often what's interesting is you really see very clearly, especially in the manuscripts, kind of the multiple kinds of knowledge that go into translation, right? So it's not just like one person sitting there who is fluent in two languages and translates from one into another, Right. It's very clear, right, that there is someone who has some kind of technical proficiency and maybe some proficiency in multiple languages, who is then doing a kind of, in a sense, an explication, a rough explication of the French text or the Italian text, whatever it is. And then there is someone else, right, whose job it is to kind of render that into an acceptable literary Arabic, let's say, right? And this actually becomes institutionalized, right? Other people have written about this, right? In by the middle of the 19th century in Egypt, right? Think about Pascal Crozet's work in particular, where there, you know, it's very clear that you have this kind of triangular expertise, right, that goes into translation as a kind of cooperative and multi-stage project. I mean, I think, you know, in the book, I'm able to trace kind of some of the more informal origins of that, you know, in places like Damiat, where, you know, it just took multiple kinds of knowledge, technical knowledge, literary knowledge, vernacular knowledge to kind of get a text from one language into another.
I'm glad you mentioned the Nahda in passing a moment ago, and it's another one of those frames that you kind of just... this is a big topic in Middle Eastern history. It's been a big topic since Albert Hourani wrote Arabic Thought in the Liberal Age, even though he never uses the term Nahda. It's a question that, I mean, in my approach, and my advisor encourages this to some extent, is to sort of sidestep the whole Nahda. And I was encouraged to see sort of do the same. I don't remember if you actually mentioned it by name, but what I appreciated about that, and I want to ask you why you did that, but I have some clues as to why, is that in many ways that allows you to sidestep another big methodological question, which is, for many years there was this assumption of Ottoman or Muslim or Arab decline in sort of the early modern period, so the 16th, 17th centuries, and there's been a lot of pushback against that recently, but you just, again, you never really address that, you just sort of glide right past it. Why?
Yeah. No, it's a great observation, and it's a fair observation. There's a bit on decline in the introduction to the book, and I think also briefly in Nahda. Right. I mean, so maybe I'll start with decline, because I think the answer to the Nahda question is sort of implicit in the answer to the decline question. Right. I mean, the decline thesis casts a long shadow on Ottoman history, Islamic history, the history of science. And one of the ways in which it casts a shadow is that you're absolutely right that, you know, for a long time it was kind of expected that if you're doing a history of science, especially in a, let's say, a kind of post-classical Islamic context, what one is trying to do is to write against the decline thesis, right? And a lot of work, including, you know, really fabulous and quite recent work, does that very effectively, right? And kind of just demonstrates the extent to which, you know, whether it's, you know, Khaled al-Ruwayhib's work on logic, right, or, you know, some of the really interesting work on early modern medicine and astronomy and astrology that's come out recently, right, just the extent to which, you know, this conventional view of, you know, whether it's post-12th century or, you know, Ottoman science, right, the extent to which this conventional view of decline is just unsupported empirically, right, it just doesn't hold up. The problem with that for me, or the trap of that, let's say, for me, is that for me, what's most interesting about the history of science is not, right, to be able to say, you know, look how intellectually productive or dynamic the culture was in, you know, in a given period. Right, I would almost take that for granted. Right, unfortunately, we couldn't take it for granted for a long time because of the strength of that decline narrative. Right, and so all of this kind of anti-decline work has been really liberating. Right, I think, in allowing us to write a different kind of history, which instead of, you know, prioritizing the question of how productive, right, was the culture, I'm interested in, the social relations and the social context and the political significance of the work, right? And so I saw, as you rightly point out, I kind of sidestepped the whole decline question because it is a bit of a trap for me, right? We're just arguing, against decline, right? In a sense, I think we're limited in the extent to which we're going to explore the political and social and cultural context, right? Because we're just kind of focused on showing, it wasn't decline, that there was dynamism, that there was kind of new production, right? Which, in another field, no one would ever bother. I mean, if you're writing a history of, science in 18th century France, right? And you say, your argument is, look how productive it was. Look how people were doing all these new things. I mean, that is not, what historians of science in that context are trying to do, right? And it's not what I want to be doing either. Right? We're trying to kind of situate science socially and explain its significance in those terms. So you're absolutely right. I kind of take for granted in a sense that, we've been kind of liberated from the decline thesis by, the work that's happened in the last, 40 years, really, and can kind of deal with science outside of that box. So that's my reason for kind of sidestepping the decline thesis.
What about the Nahda?
Right. So implicit in that, right, is the extent to which right, I mean, the Nahda, right, is itself a construct, right? I mean, it was a very kind of self-conscious kind of self-representation, right, on the part of people who, in a sense, are it's part of the history of the decline thesis itself, right? I mean, the decline thesis is not just something that comes out of, Orientalists, right, who started to write the history of Islam and the history of the Middle East in a certain way in the 19th and 20th centuries in Europe, right? It also comes out of Arab and Ottoman intellectuals, right, in that period, right, who saw themselves, right, as part of the rebirth, right, of a culture that had been that had fallen into decline, right, or had been suppressed, right. So for Arab intellectuals, right, it was increasingly, the Ottomans who were responsible for that decline. Right, and this becomes part of the kind of Arab nationalist historiography. For Muslim reformists, right, it's, very often the ulama who were responsible for decline, right, who had kind of stifled kind of the true Islam with their, kind of intellectual obscurantism. And so the Nahda, right, is very closely, I think, connected to our kind of the historiographical paradigm, right, of decline, right, from which I'm trying to kind of step away from in the book, and which, other historians of science in the Middle East have stepped away from as well. But it, in a sense, it's a, the very period, that I'm concerned with in the book, and the actors that I'm concerned with in the book, they're kind of there at the origins, right, of that historiographic paradigm, right, that the field kind of worked with, well into the 20th century. So sidestepping the Nahda, I think, is and bracketing it is in it, or coming at it from an angle where it's just not assumed, right, is part of the same concern as kind of getting outside the box of decline.
So to switch gears to something a little bit more material, we've already talked about sort of how science is distributed, how print affects astronomy, just through all of my different questions. But I was actually hoping that we would focus on something really particular that the book takes. It's a slice of the book, basically, because I think this is actually relevant to our more general audience, which is the fact that the Islamic calendar is lunar, because I take that for granted as someone who grew up and is Muslim, and I took for granted that I and currently am paying attention to the month and when the month ends, because different religious holidays fall on the lunar calendar. And this is dependent on the sighting of the moon, which varies from month to month. So can you explain more how attempts were made to regulate this?
Sure. So one of the famous debates that I wouldn't say begins, but certainly intensifies in the early 20th century, is this debate over whether to standardize the lunar calendar, right? In other words, to move from a system in which people actually have to see the new crescent for the month to begin, to a system in which the months are based on when we kind of astronomically know, right, that that new crescent is present in the sky, whether we see it or not. And of course, you know, the latter system, you know, if we compute it in advance, allows for people just to know, right, by looking at a calendar when Ramadan will begin, when it will end, when Eid will be, and so forth. So this debate really intensifies in the early 20th century. It's an old debate, right, in fiqh. But it really intensifies in the early 20th century in a way that you know that scholars in Islamic studies have attributed for a long time to new technologies of communication, right? Print journals and the telegraph, right? Which kind of make people in different parts of the world very acutely aware when, for example, they are beginning Ramadan on different dates. Right. And this becomes kind of the source of some discomfort and embarrassment, especially to the extent that it's used, you know, by people outside the community to kind of poke fun at Islamic practice in the early 20th century. Right. So you see people kind of writing to Rashid Rida in Cairo, you know, from the Russian Empire, let's say, saying, you know, people, you know, are uncomfortable with not knowing when Ramadan is going to begin or end, with the fact that we're kind of observing it at different times. It's a source of ridicule for the community. So there are attempts to regulate this or to adopt a standardized calendar, a kind of pre-calculated calendar. And, you know, the conventional understanding or the typical understanding is that they fail, right? That they're that, you know, to this day, right? The norm in most communities is to look for the crescent, right, and to base the calendar on that sighting. Now, the extent to which that's true, I think, is actually more up for debate, or it's more an open question than we realize. You know, so for one thing, right, the lunar sighting tends to be a very nationalized ritual in most places now, right? Certainly in most Muslim majority countries, right, there is kind of an official sighting, right, which in Egypt, for example, is performed by the National Observatory, right, in conjunction with scholars from the religious, the national religious institutions, right? So to the extent to which both scientific and religious authority have been nationalized in many places in the 20th century, right, the lunar sighting is also kind of a nationalized standard. So it's still based on actual observation of the crescent, but it's not necessarily done like community by community. The other thing I point out in the book is that this disagreement over whether to use calculation or not, right, whether to go by the actual crescent or as seen in the sky, or whether to kind of adopt a pre-calculated calendar, kind of takes a new shape in the early 20th century, in the sense that it's actually not the case that, you know, sighting the crescent was the universal kind of pre-modern practice, and adopting a calendar or a standardized calendar was something that kind of modernizers all of a sudden wanted to do in the late Ottoman period. It's very clear, actually, in these debates that different kinds of calculation were being practiced in communities in the 19th century, and the notion that we should observe the crescent, that one should observe the crescent, right, is something that to some extent was really popularized by reformists in the early 20th century, who actually thought that going by the visible presence of the crescent in the sky would be a more uniform practice, in a sense, a more standardizing practice than going by calculation, right? And this is something which I think seems a bit counterintuitive. Like, why would kind of having people look at the crescent in the sky kind of create a more uniform observance of the calendar than going by what astronomers say. But actually, in the early 20th century, like the calendars that were available to people, the almanacs that were produced right at that time, often disagreed about the calendar and about when the new moon would be visible. Whereas the idea was, if you just kind of looked at the sky, right, that was something which people would not disagree about, right? And which especially, you know, when you kind of link that observation of the sky with telegraphy, right, you're going to get a more uniform observance than if you base it on the calendars, right, which are often in the early 20th century computed by different methods or are wrong, right? So I think in a weird way, or in an unexpected way, right, the decision in the early 20th century, or the way the debate kind of unfolds, where in most places people decide to stick with observation of the crescent, was actually a choice that people made with the sense that this would actually be a more uniform observance, right? Something which would get people observing Ramadan actually more at the same time rather than at different times.
So sort of to begin closing the interviews, I wanted to ask you about archives and sources, because one thing that's constantly on my radar is the fact that archives are increasingly, in the Middle Eastern context, increasingly difficult to get to. And of course, this isn't to say that the enormous human tragedies that are happening on both an institutional but also on plainly a material level in the Middle East, in the form of the Syrian civil war, or the revolution, or what's been happening in Libya, Palestine, Lebanon, has meant that the peoples of those countries are suffering immensely, and not to belittle that at all, but access to these people's histories, and in some of our cases in our own histories, is increasingly difficult. And for young practitioners in history, it's difficult to get into, for example, the Egyptian National Archives, put it frankly. The Syrian National Archives don't exist to people coming from Western academies anymore, even in universities or institutions in the Middle East. So what would sort of your advice be to young practitioners of history writing, even though you were working from a very different context?
I appreciate the question. I would say a few things. First of all, you know, our histories are always going to be shaped by the moment that we live in. And to the extent that we're kind of conscious about that, and our present political moment, I think, makes it hard not to be conscious of that fact. I think it actually strengthens our writing, right? As opposed to writing history in a way where, you know, yeah, we just assume that we have all of, you know, these kinds of access and archival resources, and some of the assumptions, methodological assumptions, actually wind up being kind of submerged or buried, and not examined, right? And the extent to which, you know, sure, you know, we had access, you know, 10 years ago to the Egyptian National Archives in a way that's not possible right now. But the Egyptian National Archives itself, right, and the Dar al-Wathaq, right, is a very particular kind of system, and makes certain kinds of history available, right, rather than others. And so I think, you know, that situation of relatively open archival access meant that sometimes we weren't always as explicit about our methodology and the kinds of history we were doing, whereas today it's unavoidable, right? I mean, you can't do you know, Middle East history right now and not be really direct about what the limitations are. And I think, as you say, kind of that's tragic, and there's a larger human tragedy behind that, which is more important. But if we're being explicit about, you know, the kinds of history that are possible for us to write, I think that's actually not a bad thing. The other thing I would say is that, you know, looking at my book, for example, I mean, there are substantial parts of it that would still be perfectly possible to research. And one thing that I encourage people to do is not to underestimate, for example, the potential of manuscript collections for writing certainly 19th century history in the Middle East. Less so maybe 20th century, but certainly for the 19th century, right? Some of these manuscript libraries, which exist in the Middle East and which tend to have fewer restrictions on them than archives, right, are really rich sources for not just intellectual history, but cultural history, social history of the period. I mean, my book just scratches the surface of what's available in the manuscript collections of the Dar al-Kutub, right? Even just in terms of astronomy in the 19th century, let alone other subjects. So I encourage people to think about manuscript collections, which obviously also exist outside the Middle East, for thinking about the 19th century and not just thinking about, you know, the periods where manuscripts are more typically used. Methodologically, that's another suggestion.
No, I'm really excited about what is going to come out of this period in particular, because it is forcing, I think, both my generation and any generation that's writing history right now, really, to think more creatively about what is an archive and what is a source and where can you get those things. And simply because the official version of that history, such as the National Archives in Egypt or the State Archives, State Zionist Archives in Israel, are not as readily available, doesn't mean that you can't find an archive somewhere else. You just have to be a little bit more creative, a little bit more assertive. And a little bit more wily, I think, at the same time, in choosing how you frame your project to individuals when you encounter them, and willing to just follow, just to go down a rabbit hole at any point in time.
I think so. Yeah. No, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go.
I think a lot of people, you know, who are working on projects right now in the region I talk to are working with family archives, right, private archives. And that, you know, sometimes is just a stroke of luck, right, through connections. But it also often means being in closer contact with colleagues in the region, right, at universities in the region, which is not a bad thing. And it's probably something we should do more anyway. There are resources available for working with those kinds of archives, right, for digitizing them, right? I'm thinking of the Endangered Archives Initiative in particular. Right. So there is funding available for that kind of work. So I think, right, in a sense that ultimately we're going to be shifted away from just kind of parking ourselves in the state archives. More interesting or certainly just new and different kinds of history are going to emerge in the long term. I mean, people are not, it's not as though people have stopped doing archival research in the Middle East. It's just going to look different.
Yeah, and I, by no means do I wish to sort of dismiss your book or the country that your book focuses on, Egypt, but there is quite a lot of, Egypt is quite, to some extent, overrepresented in the history of the Middle East. I mean, I have a chapter on Egypt, but I still think that Egypt is quite overrepresented. So hopefully that means that people will start looking, for example, at modern Jordan, which the archives for that are extremely rich and are almost untapped. North Africa needs to be thought of differently and in new and interesting ways. There's new opportunities for writing about the Arab Gulf. That field of studies is also to some extent untapped. You're still writing those national histories, in fact. And then also just thinking of Egypt differently. So hopefully this will lead to new and interesting studies. And on that same note, can you sort of give us a teaser of what you're working on right now? What projects you have in the pipeline?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So I've started a new project recently on the late Ottoman public debt, the bankruptcy and then debt administration, right, that takes place both in Istanbul and in Cairo in the last two decades or two and a half decades of the 19th century, and approaching that topic less from the vantage point of economic history, right, where there's, you know, a longstanding literature on the debt, and more from the vantage point of a kind of history of expertise, right, that comes out of my, you know, training in history of science. So I'll be working on that. Hopefully, not going to have a chance really to get going on the archival aspects of that this year, but hopefully next summer at the latest, I'll be doing more work on that. I'm excited to be working on a history that will be a bit geographically different from the first project. It'll have kind of parts of it that are centered in Egypt, but I think on the whole, it'll be more a kind of a broader Ottoman story, right, that includes Istanbul as well as other provinces where the debt administration was really present. So I'm looking forward to that.
That's exciting. I mean, not to speak of other underrepresented fields of history within Middle Eastern history, or subfields within Middle East history. I think economic history is starting to, there's an upswing. And I'm really excited to see that happen as well, because I think, especially, I think oftentimes historians can forget how much their work intersects with other people's. And mm-hmm. think a little bit more in terms of context sometimes, especially in intellectual history. So that's really exciting. And congratulations on the new book. It's really, I think it's going to be a fixture for a while.
Thank you so much. It's really nice to speak with you.